I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, January 5th. If it's January, it must be Ian Bremmer time on The Brian Lehrer Show. Ian, as many of you public television watchers will know, is host of G-Zero World on PBS and president of the Eurasia Group, which specializes in helping companies understand political risks to their businesses in the U.S. and around the world. And every January, he releases a projection of the top political risks for the year ahead. His number one risk for 2021 is Joe Biden taking office in such a polarized country, followed by the long-term effects of COVID on society, then global cooperation giving way to global competition on fighting climate change. That's a really interesting one, I think, and little discussed, so we'll discuss it, and others on the list that we'll get to. Ian also gives us three red herrings for 21, things that people are too concerned about, and some of those might surprise you too. Hi, Ian. Happy 2021, and welcome back to WNYC.
And to you. The pandemic can't keep us down, Brian.
Absolutely not. Now, we will get to the risks flowing from Biden taking office in such a divided country. But let's talk first about your risk number three, which is also, I think, an opportunity, not just a risk, global competition to dominate the clean energy market. Who's competing for what?
Definitely is an opportunity. And it's in some ways the best thing that's come out of this pandemic. Let's be clear. The biggest stimulus and relief in the world came out of Europe with Merkel and Macron driving massive redistribution and overwhelmingly green and sustainable. And not just inside Europe, but also for people that want to trade with Europe, really aligning that trade with green energy, or there are going to be significant tariffs and taxes. You've got Biden winning. And while that plays out in terms of the divisions that we'll talk about, the change between Biden and Trump on climate, which wouldn't have happened, frankly, if there wasn't a pandemic, it's by far the most significant shift between the two leaders. The Japanese, the new Prime Minister Suga, very significant orientation in terms of net zero and carbon emissions, and China, too. So when we think about 2021, in terms of trying to protect the planet and keep the world at 2 degrees Celsius warming or 2.5, you know, there's more of a shot of that actually happening because of the politics that come from coronavirus. But it's very important to recognize that climate change doesn't suddenly mean that the differences and the geopolitical tensions and the lack of trust and the lack of leadership around the world goes away. And indeed, what's going to happen as all of the world's leaders start focusing on what comes after fossil fuels is they're also going to start competing very heavily. And that competition and how it plays out is what we write about in risk number three.
And so your frame is political risks, but it sounds like you also see this as a good thing. Like if the U.S. and China are competing for market dominance in post-fossil fuel energy sectors, if capitalism is becoming intent on selling clean energy systems to everyone, then that helps the planet outrun those industries that pollute, at least in theory.
Well, let me give you an example. I mean, Brian, it's clearly good for the world that we have lots of people working on vaccines for coronavirus to respond, right? Mm-hmm. But let's be clear that if you have a global pandemic, what you want is the world working together on vaccines. You don't want the United States leaving the World Health Organization, refusing to join COVAX, and the poorer countries saying, what's going on? You don't want the Americans and Chinese pointing fingers at each other, sowing disinformation and mistrust. And so what we're going to get, you just suggested, there's going to be the equivalent of everyone working on vaccines. Everyone will be working on sustainable energy. But the Chinese have been actually trying to become global leaders in electric vehicles and infrastructure for that, rare earth metals that are required as a consequence on the commodity side, locking them up in that production, solar, wind, nuclear. The United States is absolutely going to want to dominate those fields. And that competition with China will not only drive worse relations between the two countries, but in some areas, like when you think about a smart grid, and the fact that there's critical data, we'll be saying, we're not going to let the Chinese into our grid or into other countries that are allied with us. So you're going to have the same level of confrontation, lack of transparency and fighting, which is a problem when you think about the world's two largest economies in climate, where I think when you thought about climate for the last 20, 30 years, most of those people thought, well, if we finally start addressing climate, the world will come together. We'll save the whales. We'll save the planet. Actually, I don't think it's going to bring the world closer together, even as we try to save it.
Interesting. And your section on the polarization between Democrats and Republicans in America and the risk that presents nevertheless includes a caveat that Democrats and Republicans have a shared desire to contain China. And I'm curious about that shared interest. I mean, Trump, as we know, sought to vilify China at every turn and portray the previous bipartisan push for open trade with China to have been a disaster for American jobs and even a disaster for having control over our own emergency pharmaceutical supply, as we learned last year. So has he pretty much won that argument in political terms in Washington? China is an enemy, not a trading partner?
I think he has won that argument. And you'll remember, Brian, that when Biden first threw his hat in the ring, he actually said, what are you talking about? China's a major threat. Like, they can't do anything to us. You know, this is they're not a significant power. And I mean, this really showed you that Biden, since he was vice president, had really taken his eye off the policy ball. He was brutalized on that, but by his own party, in addition to the Republicans. He got up to speed pretty quickly. He doesn't say that anymore. I mean, if you were to talk about where Trump has really identified where the world is going, you know, you'd probably point to two areas of foreign policy. One would be the new geopolitics of the Middle East. I mean, the fact that you have peace deals and diplomacy now between Israel and a number of Arab countries, even when John Kerry said that could not happen unless there was Israeli-Palestinian peace. If Obama and Biden had recognized just how much the Middle East was changing, the geopolitics, they could have done that deal. They didn't. Trump picked it up. Same thing happened on China. Obama and Biden just did not recognize the level of hostility that was growing and mistrust among some of the corporate community in the United States, certainly on issues like Hong Kong, South China Sea, with the Indian government. I mean, we now talk about the Quad. Trump picked that up, but it's got broad bipartisan support, and I don't see that changing in any way significantly as Biden becomes president.
So is there an emerging Biden-Harris China policy that looks different from the Obama-Biden China policy?
Sure. I mean, you'll remember when Obama made his first trip to Beijing and he had that town hall and they didn't allow media in. It was kind of scripted and censored. And it was a lot of people criticized Biden for kind of getting played by the Chinese government. Now, keep in mind, this is before Belt and Road. This is before Xi Jinping ended term limits inside China. So a lot of things have been happening inside China, too. It's not like it's the same exact China we're dealing with. And of course, it's gotten bigger. Plus, they, you know, covered up the first 4 weeks of coronavirus transfers while hundreds of thousands of Chinese were traveling outside of China from Wuhan. So there's a lot going on here. But yes, a Biden-Harris administration on China is going to be considerably more assertive on issues like technology, on Hong Kong, on the Uyghurs and human rights. And they will try to engage multilaterally to get American allies on board. I mean, frankly, Trump has been very unilateralist. But even so, Trump's 5G policy telling allies, don't you dare work with Huawei or ZTE, a large number of American allies have gotten on board with that policy. That will be made easier with a Biden administration that, you know, a lot of allies will have an easier time working with, seeing eye to eye with.
And Ian, you call the number two political risk to the economy for this year long COVID. And you acknowledge that obviously the most concerning thing about long COVID is that it's still killing so many people. But you say it could also threaten economies and political stability. What's the political stability side of that?
Well, let's at least first talk about the good news briefly, which is that I do think that the number of people that are getting killed from coronavirus, is, especially in the advanced economies, the wealthy world, is going to go down real, real fast. I mean, in a matter of weeks in the United States, we'll have 10% of the population vaccinated. And that will probably bring down mortality rates by 90%. And that's why this isn't risk number one, right? I mean, just the fact that you and I, how many people that we care about, that we love, are truly vulnerable, are 80 years plus, or have underlying conditions, and we're just concerned that if they get this, they really could die. Mm-hmm. That is just going to come off of us in relatively short order, and thank God. So that's not a 2021 risk for the majority of the year, but the economics don't magically get better. In fact, in 2020, the world largely responded pretty robustly on the economic side, including in the United States. We got the relief to people that they needed, and so did the rest of the world. In 2021, the U.S. won't do as well on that front, and other countries will have a harder time.
I'll throw in my own little caveat. Sort of got the relief to people that they needed in the developed world, judging from the lines for food pantries and things like that. Sort of got the relief, but go ahead.
No, I take your point, but if you ask me, you know, this is in an incredibly divided United States, the bipartisanship that came from Pelosi and Mnuchin very quickly getting trillions of dollars out there did really make a difference. And the Japanese did that, the Europeans did that, and the emerging markets did that too. My point here is not to say that we got it perfect. We got it a lot better than we did the healthcare side, the mask wearing side, the everything else side, the hospital side. But 2021, no one that looks at stimulus thinks that, oh, we're going to continue to be able to take care of those that aren't in the knowledge economy. And that is going to drive massive inequality. So inside the United States, as the markets continue to do incredibly well, and as the growth numbers, everyone says, oh, great, we're recovering. But the average American isn't recovering at all. And that's going to be a problem in Europe. That's going to be an even bigger problem for the lower and middle income countries that won't actually have the vaccines and can't get back to normal. But they also don't have the fiscal space to provide the support for their people. So 2021 on the economic side can drive a lot of political instability.
And on the economy also, we've seen the shocking disparity since the pandemic of unemployment and the Dow both spiking. The rich are getting richer and the working class and poor are getting poorer. How do you see that changing with COVID's long tail or with the vaccinations?
Getting much worse, Brian. I mean, you know, it's very clear that one of the things that coronavirus has done is it has driven technology firms and anyone in the digital and knowledge economy, those are the winners. But what about everyone else? What about the so-called essential workers that we treat as cannon fodder in this country? I mean, I hate to use that term, but it's a reality for decades, and it's become so incredibly clear and visceral this year with coronavirus. These people take it on the chin. It gets much, much worse for them. And at a time that the big decision makers and the power players in the economy are worried less because it's rebounded for them. Global demand is back. So I fear that gets worse. It also drives, and you know we're heading towards this, it drives a lot more inequality and the illegitimacy of institutions in the United States.
Fitta in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Ian Bremmer. Hi, Fitta.
Hi, Ian. My question to you is, what do you see happening this year for human rights issues across the world? As an Indian, I am quite heartened by the fact that we have a Biden presidency, which may somehow put some checks and balances in place for, you know, unfettered authoritarianism that's taking hold in India. And like all over the world, like the coronavirus has propagated issues of human rights, both in this country and abroad. What do you have to say on that? And where do you see the world going with regards to human rights issues?
Yeah, so, you know, Modi, your own Indian prime minister, has been good on anti-corruption, but horrible on human rights. And the U.S.-India relationship is on balance better than it has been, in part because the China relationship is so much worse, and both leaders support that. That's going to continue under Biden. So, I mean, even though the Biden administration will be more consistent in not only what they say, but also walking the talk on human rights, where Trump obviously really didn't care about it. So you'd have Pompeo making statements, but the administration having virtually zero interest. Even though that's going to change, this is a world that is much more fragmented in terms of the willingness and ability to uphold values like that. I mean, you look at what's happened to Hong Kong. The Chinese have unilaterally ended the one state, two systems arrangement. And the only response that's been effective is the UK giving citizenship and passports to a lot of people that want to get out. But there's no more ability to be democratic opposition. You just had, you know, the head of the major newspaper taken away in leg irons, right? And so, I mean, when you're talking about things that are considered domestic sovereign issues, the impunity that my friend David Miliband, the former British Foreign Secretary, coins this as the age of impunity. And the age of impunity comes directly on the back of what I call a G-zero world. An absence of leadership, human rights becomes, unfortunately, a lower common denominator.
And let's end, Ian, with the top of your list. We saved number one for last, your top, quote-unquote, political risk of 2021, and that is that we are going to have the second president in a row who is seen as illegitimate by almost half the country. And that is certainly disturbing from a national unity and a social progress standpoint, but you also see it affecting the economy. How so?
Yeah, the economy and our position globally. I mean, look, I think the reason the Europeans just did this massive trade deal with China after they knew that Biden had won the election, and we had heard, well, you know, as long as Biden wins, things will get better with the Europeans. Because the Europeans look at the United States, they see how divided we are, and they don't think they can count on us as much as they could before. And so they're hedging more with China. My God, that affects the global economy in a big way. A very weak and divided government, a very weak and divided Congress that is seen as rigged, and a very weak president who has a hard time governing across the aisle and a hard time putting the Democrats even together. You know, normally you might not worry as much about that, but in a time of crisis, both domestically and globally, when you really need the country to come together, when you really need less fake news, less disinformation, when you need more stimulus, and again, we talked about that already. You said it wasn't even that good in 2020. It's going to be a lot worse in 2021 when suddenly, you know, people are facing evictions. People are facing getting thrown out on the streets. Homelessness in 2021 in the U.S., I fear, is going to go up a lot. That's unacceptable for the wealthiest country in the world. And it comes because our institutions have indeed eroded. I mean, when Trump says that he won this election, he is lying. He's lying, even though a lot of senators and representatives and much of his voters are going with him. But when Trump says the system is rigged against Americans, they're, you know, kind of like on China, like on the Middle East. He has stumbled upon a fundamental truth that increasingly American political institutions do not serve the interests of the average American. And that is getting much worse in this period of coronavirus.
And listeners, and Ian, indulge me, listeners, let me use this as an opportunity for a promo for the special that I'll be hosting tomorrow. It's a 2-hour national call-in special tomorrow night from 8 to 10. Called America, Are We Ready to Reconcile? It's part of our national America, Are We Ready series. And this time, America, Are We Ready to Reconcile? And I will admit, and I'll tell the national audience this tomorrow night, that when we planned this show, we did not anticipate what is apparently now going to happen in Congress tomorrow, which is that there are going to be hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of debate over accepting the Electoral college results from many states. We know that Trump isn't going to overturn it because he doesn't have the numbers in Congress, but it wasn't looking like it was going to go this way, because it takes senators as well as members of the House to object to seating electors from Pennsylvania or Georgia or other states. And it looked at first like senators were not going to sign on. So tomorrow was going to be more or less the pro forma congressional role at the end of a presidential election, which is to just seat the electors and then on to the inauguration. So we were planning America, Are We Ready to Reconcile? Well, tomorrow, on the same day as this national special, it's going to be blowing up in Washington with big protests, mostly pro-Trump, and this debate in Congress that might go on until the wee hours of Thursday morning. So it's going to be a combination now of live coverage of tomorrow's drama and this bigger question, America, Are We Ready to Reconcile? So all of that by way of saying, tune in if you're interested. That's tomorrow night from 8 to 10, and tell your friends around the country, because that's a national special tomorrow night. Ian, you want to tell anybody as you go, if you're in season on G-Zero World on PBS Now, anything to promote?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I mean, you know, first of all, we're promoting what you're doing tomorrow night. It is a historic day. In our lifetimes, it will be the most dysfunctional our democracy has ever been. This is the worst election since 1876. And if you're a citizen and you care at all, and if you're listening to Brian, you obviously do. And I hope you'll tune into that. As for me, and I was delighted to hear so many fans of the show online. I mean, check your local listings here in New York. It's Saturday right after News Hour at 6:30 every week. But it's all across the country every week. And this week we've got Jay Johnson, the former Homeland Security Secretary and a good friend, who's talking about that Russia hack and how we respond to all of that.
Ian Bremmer, host of the G-Zero World on PBS and president of the Eurasia Group, which publishes every January its list of the top political risks for the coming year. Thank you for sharing it with us and being so interesting.
Always a pleasure, Matt. Be good.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.